From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt. Our colleague Noel is on an adventure, but will be returning shortly.
They called me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. That makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. All praise to the codes. All praise to the cables. The world is full of hidden things. You know, Matt, this is something you and I have been talking about for a while off air, and I think I hazard we're both pretty fascinated. We're both pretty excited, maybe, to explore this today. It's spooky stuff. We've talked before in the past. We did a number of live shows a few years back where we talked about hidden things all around you, right? Like hidden languages of the city, facade buildings, all that stuff. But we never really talked about how some of the biggest hidden things in the world today concern information. Not even just like, I know when we say information, we all think like, oh, top secret stuff. Oh, the aliens are real. But it's more like, it's equally important to learn how information is transported, the physical structure that gets it from point A to point Z and beyond. You know, I don't know about you, but for a long time, I didn't put much thought into this. I was just like, oh, the modem works, or oh, the cable's out.
Yeah. I think maybe it has to do with the way our individual apartments and homes are connected to the information hub, like you're talking about, Ben. For us, it is a cable that is run into our house, right? Mm-hmm. Usually a single cable, whether that's, you know, a fiber optic from like AT&T or for a time Google, or, you know, an Xfinity literal like coaxial cable that runs into your house. Like that's the way we get information, and that's the hub. But what's that cable connected to, and where's the server that has all the information that makes up Reddit?
Mm-hmm. What is that tiny tendril that goes into your house? Where does that come from? Right?
It's a capillary.
Yeah, that capillary. That's a great word for it. Most people who are not in industries related to this don't put too much thought into it. Just make sure it works. Call someone if it doesn't. And we all know that if a few things go wrong, people discover this during the pandemic, with just your little cable, your life will change for a few days. It will become more complicated. And it turns out that is true on a macro scale. If just a ludicrously, cartoonishly small number of things go wrong in the world, the house of communicative cards may collapse entirely. And so tonight's question: how easy would it be to collapse some or all of the global communication network? Here are the facts. I guess before we talk about that, we need to just set up a quick background on communication and codes. In fact, Matt, you and I, when we were working together on this episode, we were thinking we can do codes and code breaking and undersea cables as one thing. And that turned out not to be the case. This isn't even everything about undersea cables, but it's crazy.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And as we tried to get on here, we attempted to use the system that we generally use to record remotely. I'm at my house, Ben's at his house, Mission Control's at his house, and we get together through our cables and we can see each other and talk to each other and we record. But that system was down when we got on, guys. Just pointing that out. Ooh. Just pointing that out. We're doing it a different way today. Actually, this is kind of an old school way that we used to do every time.
Yeah.
But just for a little peek behind the curtain, when something goes down, as you said, Ben, it can really affect things. So a company located somewhere in Israel, their stuff goes down, and now we can't record way over here in Atlanta and New York. Sorry, Paul.
Yes. Yeah. Or anywhere, because we have used this same platform internationally, fairly often in the past, you know, and, we are, of course, immensely astounded and grateful to do something that is essentially is like a high level spell at any other time in history, right?
Oh, yeah. You don't need anything. Just connect your internet thing and your camera and your microphone and everybody's good to go. That's magic, man. You're right, Ben. Let's jump into codes, cryptography, sending information way far away. And how do you make sure only your intended person understands what that message is?
Yeah, cryptography, the proper, the discipline, the systematic study of codes and how codes can be created or broken. Weirdly enough, it's a very new science. It only started around 100 years ago, but it turns out since the dawn of recorded history, people have been trying to communicate with other specific people in a way that doesn't allow outsiders to participate. The first known evidence of cryptography in some kind of form goes all the way back to 1900 BC or BCE. Your mileage may vary. There's this chamber in the tomb of a nobleman in Egypt named Nunhotep II. And at some point, in the creation of this chamber, this burial structure, an unknown scribe, whose name is lost to history, started styling on the hieroglyphs. They started writing weird things, just weird insertions of stuff that usually wouldn't go in your funereal writing.
Yeah, it's interesting. So when we're thinking about codes and attempting to hide something in plain sight like that, because again, any code could potentially be read or received by anyone. As we said, it's only supposed to be deciphered by, you know, the intended recipients, right? So in this case, the way that these hieroglyphics were changed, it's almost as if it wasn't necessarily hiding a message or something. It was to change the message a little bit, right?
Yeah, it was to make it pop. And the more I've thought about this since researching it, Matt, the more it reminds me of that halcyon period of the internet in the early 2000s, where people would write stuff in message boards and they would start putting in random lowercase x's, you know, especially to indicate they were like hardcore or something that would change this message. Or, you know, it could remind you in earlier analog days of notes that children would pass in grade school and they would want their penmanship to have a pop to it. So instead of the dots atop the eye, you get the hearts, you know, and the little smiley face. So maybe this guy was just zhuzhing it up because he loved this Egyptian noble so much. But to your point, and this is an open question in Egyptology, people are not sure whether this was to, again, just make the thing seem more formal and fancy and beautiful and intricate, or whether the placement of those symbols, just like the placement of Fjord in Illuminatus trilogy, they weren't sure whether it was meant to change the context of what was being written or carved, I guess. And this, because it indicates some transformation of the original text, it is the oldest known predecessor of cryptography today. So the other interesting thing here is if you look at most major early civilizations, there is some form of encoding and transmitting information. And we found a great example from ancient Indian civilization, was something called the Arthashastra.
Whoa, this sounds really interesting. So this is like, this is some kind of secret language that was used specifically for a spy service?
Yeah, this is, and we got this from a great security blog called redhat.com. This is, this appears to be, I should say, some Kissinger level MI6 James Bond stuff. Because the guy who writes it at the time, this is 350 to 275 BCE. He's a prime minister of his state. His name's Kautilya, so shades of Kissinger. And he talks about how his civilization has a well-established, sophisticated espionage service. And he talks about giving assignments to spies and operators in what translates to secret writing. So codes. And, you know, I guess this is back in the day, man, where they could have done, the BCE version of two sketchy guys in fedoras at a park asking weird questions as codes, you know? Mm-hmm. I always thought that was so silly, but people really did it. Anyway, so that's history of cryptography, ancient past. It's its own bag of badgers. It's worth exploring. We're talking about this off air in a future episode or a future series of episodes. And, you know, when you think of cryptography and code breaking today in the West, at least, you probably think about the heroic story of Turing breaking the Enigma machine. But the weirdest thing about code breakers right now that we need to know is a lot outside of Turing, a lot of the historically world changing heroic acts of code breaking, they probably remain classified today. And that's because what they did was so important. And we're part of it. We are all part of it. It doesn't matter if you are a civilian, doesn't matter if you're military, doesn't matter if you're, you know, on your merry way in some other pursuit. If you have an internet connection, you are involved with using codes in your day-to-day life. And you may not realize it, but all that streaming video, Matt, the streaming video you and Paul and I are using now, all those articles you might read, the podcasts, the audiobooks, they originate from somewhere else before they reach that little cable that reaches a modem, or before they reach the little, before they fly out from their server to reach your phone. They come from somewhere.
Yeah, and they're also encrypted. All of that data is encrypted. End-to-end encryption is the thing now. And even if you go to a website or you use an app, it doesn't matter. There's a reason it says HTTPS now rather than HTTP. It's because everything is secured. And those communications, it's a must because so many people have access and so many people have an understanding of how the system works. It's all got to be basically secret.
Mm-hmm. And being unable to code, to write some, in some degree of a computer language, make no mistake, folks, in the near future, not being able to do that is going to be a lot like being illiterate in the 1800s. It's a big deal. And when we talk about this great communications web, which you've heard, I'm sure, in countless TED Talks, folks, it naturally conjures these images of satellite links, you know, Starlink, orbital systems. You got an eye in the sky that is making sure you can watch Eurovision in real time. The truth of the matter is not that. That does exist. People do use that. That is on the way. But the vast majority of communication on this planet is much more terrestrial. As we have foreshadowed here, right now, the bulk of global communication does not occur in space. It occurs under the ocean.
Oh, yeah. I wonder if anyone out there has the experience I had where a long time ago, I had a wealthy family member, you know, like kind of distant family member, visited their house. They had this thing that I had never seen before as a kid. It was satellite television. and it's what you're describing there early there, Ben, where they had a satellite dish on their roof somewhere and it connected up to a literal satellite. And that's how they were getting the television signal. But it happened to be a stormy day that day. So this brand new, awesome satellite TV thing they had was all scrambled and crappy. You know, I just remember thinking, well, that's weird. That doesn't make sense. That's expensive. But, you know, that's that. I think that's one of the major reasons what we're talking about today, these undersea cables, are so primary, so the absolute backbone to any internet communication, any telecommunication.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a fun memory too, man, because I had experience with that sort of stuff too, and had the same disconnect on multiple levels. Like, we're paying this much and the weather is our arbiter. The weather basically holds our remote control.
Yeah. Well, it was like the first time having a car and putting on an AM radio station in a thunderstorm and going, what the heck is going on? Why does it sound so horrible? Oh, it's if interference literally in the sky, that's what's happening. This isn't great.
And then it makes you wonder about how many signals are shooting through your physical body. But that's a story for another evening, right? So satellites involve some amazing human innovation, some astonishing engineering and math, but they're still not as they're not as reliable nor as versatile as the established infrastructure, which runs invisible throughout the world's ocean. A small army of undersea or subsea cables, as they're called in the industry, crosses the world. It makes modern civilization possible. And we'll get to it, but just so you know, folks, if you see one of these cables, they're not super impressive. They look like if Godzilla was a garden hose, they look like Mecha Godzilla. They look like an armored garden hose with some tar leaking out.
Yeah, I've heard it described as actually this soda can I'm holding up is smaller than, I guess, the girth of these cables.
Yeah.
They have like a standard soda can is basically how big this thing is. And often it's buried, right?
Sure.
Like within the ground of the seafloor, at least that's how it begins. But then there are portions of it where it's going to protrude and you're actually just going to see this cabling running across the ocean floor.
Yeah, this might be helpful to paint the picture for us and our fellow conspiracy realists. Okay, no judgment on anyone, but think of your entertainment center or your gaming, your computer station at your house. You probably have it on some sort of furniture, maybe. And either way, you have a mass of wires connecting things behind that shelf or that desk. Now, you may be someone who's super into cable management and organization, so you might have the nice little, like, plastic ties, keeping stuff in order. But if you're like many people, you got a weird bowl of spaghetti back there. You got the one cable, the tendril of the great communication sphere connecting you to the world. Then you got your power cords, your HDMI lines, Ethernet, etc. It can look pretty crazy back there. And the ocean is kind of like that. It's definitely going to be more like that as time continues, unless there is an unprecedented scientific breakthrough. And it's been that way for a while. The very first international, like, undersea cable is older than modern cryptography, really. It was laid in August of 1858, or that's when it became operational. And its whole purpose was to send Morse code across the Atlantic. Just beep, 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 beep.
Yeah. Well, and there was a bunch of cabling before that that didn't stretch quite that long, right? Like they were connecting up smaller land masses across a large ocean or sea or, you know, whatever, body of water. It is crazy that in 71, the entire planet, except for a couple of small places, was connected by this type of cable. So you could telegraph pretty much anywhere.
Except for Antarctica.
Yeah.
They know what they did. Anyway, so the...
well, and again, smaller masses of land, like smaller island systems generally, were also very often not fully connected.
Right.
Which is something that even now there are places that don't have one of these cables running directly to them, right? That do have to rely on other systems. But... like, gosh, if I'm just thinking about it now, Ben, pretty much everywhere on the planet has one of these undersea cables, at least pretty close to it.
Yeah, the proximity has increased. It will continue to increase as well. And I think you make a fantastic point about the disparity of connection. You know, there are a lot of places that logistically are just very difficult to connect. And then, of course, the dominant religion of economics also gets in the way. So the two big things that are determining how this network grows are, one, geography, and two, the school of thought called economics, or the financial state, right? How many coupons can we get for doing this? And so these later generations of cable, they evolve, they start carrying things like telephone information or telephonic communication. And now these humble cables carry pretty much all the information. Like the vast majority of information, if you get it online, it arrives via one of these cables, scooting at an incredibly fast speed along these tiny glass threads, thousands of miles long, that are just out in the open ocean. Maybe they're buried sometimes. They are buried sometimes, let's be fair. But we're going to explore all kinds of statistics regarding this network. There's so much that we're honestly not going to get to because, you know, Matt and I are old school how stuff works guys. So we will easily, if we're not careful, we will easily spend hours just saying, oh, and here's how this works. And, oh, did you know? We're going to get to a lot.
We just spent 21 minutes or however long it's been on like a page and a half of notes that we have on this stuff because we just want to talk about it. Sorry,
it's
guys.
Hopefully you find it fascinating too. And before we break for a word from our sponsors, I want to set you up with one big conspiratorial question, and just, you know, the heart and soul of stuff that I want you to know. How easy would it be to damage these things? Could you topple modern civilization by literally cutting the cord?
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Here's where it gets crazy. Yes, absolutely. There are several ways to do this. I'm so glad you asked. But before we get into that, let's go. Let's help people visualize what this looks like. If you had an atlas of undersea cable, what would that map be?
Yes, I would recommend everyone, if you are not driving right now, head on over to submarinecablemap.com, and you can actually visualize what the cable systems look like. This is all the global cable systems that are known to exist. We're assuming, by the way, for this episode, that there are several systems that we can't see and that are not mapped.
Right.
But these are the official ones that exist. Now, if you take a look at this map and then you visualize yourself encountering the planet Earth, right? Mm-hmm. This sphere thing. Yes, it's a sphere. You encounter the sphere thing that has lots of water that appears blue, lots of land that appears green and brown, different shades. And if you could see this cabling running across the planet, you might think, oh, this planet is some kind of mixture of biological machinery, like system, right? It almost looks as though these things are, maybe using the analogy of a human anatomy system, these things are all connected and make this planet alive in some way. I don't know. It looks strange. It looks like veins and arteries that are connecting different land masses.
And think of it too, you know, Gaia is cyborg. That's a really interesting concept, Matt. It reminds me of a nervous system. It reminds me of that beautiful and terrifying experiment conducted in Japan where fungi naturally mapped out the train system of Japan. And it does look like somewhere the dots of the origin points will make it look a little bit like a circuit board. That's gone nuts.
It reminds me a lot of building my first computer, like desktop computer, when I learned how to do that long, long time ago with just the cabling inside there, connecting up various parts of the motherboard to the other components. It's fascinating.
Also, you can see the disparity that dates back all the way to the days of the telegraph. There are clearly empty areas. The South Pacific is one. You know, you go under Africa, like once you get a few hundred miles south of South Africa, there's nothing. And there's nothing connecting Antarctica yet officially. The closest would be Puerto Williams in Chile, which is not a big tourist destination for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. And New Zealand is encroaching. Yeah. Not quite.
And there's, you know, of course, landlocked countries get the short shrift here because there's undersea cable will have to go to the surface to reach them. So sorry, all stands except for Pakistan.
But Ben, that's such a great point. So for all this undersea cabling you're looking at, if you're looking at the website, there is a crap ton of overland cable, the same type that connects up all the major cities, all the major hubs that have data running to them that then get sent out in the other cable systems that are, you know, some of them are still above ground. It is, that's weirding me out, like visualizing all the cable that's laid across the planet.
The reason this is only a submarine cable map is because if it was in all the cable map, it would be nigh illegible.
Yeah.
It's a great thing because it shows us the disparity. It shows us the communication centers, and it also shows us in a pretty efficient way. It shows us population centers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, depending on what your purposes are, it also shows you
targets.
Right. Just so. And right now, it's nuts. I'm glad you mentioned the secrecy. This is inherently conspiratorial stuff, folks. We looked into the work of a lot of analytics firms, and one that is the most prominent, gets quoted the most often in trade organizations and in popular publications as well, is an analyst firm called Telegeography. And they're doing some pretty best in class work for the public. As of 2023, they said that this year they know of 552 existing or planned subsea cables, with more doubtlessly on the way. And they're focusing on subsea cables. They have other work that touches other forms of communication. But one important note we should make is those land cables, which still, you know, they're very much in existence, they can be a lot harder to trace, especially if you get into the interior of a country with secrets like the US, Russia, or China. So it's actually a little bit easier to find the oceanic cables. And we mentioned a little bit, do we want to talk a little bit more about their cutaway, like how they look on the inside?
Oh yeah, I found a really great image of this too, Ben. I'm going to find it here. I found one on vox.com. This is an article that you can find right now titled "A Map of All the Underwater Cables That Connect the Internet." And they've got a cutaway here. Oh, they pulled it from Wikipedia.
The Wikipedia cutaway. Okay, look, Wikipedia is not a solid source, let's be honest. But the cutaway from Wikipedia in this case is legit. Like the diagram is, you've got a bunch of coating. So you got a polyethylene insulator, copper sheathing. Inside of that, you've got steel wires for rigidity and frankly for armor. And then you've got inside of all that, the little Matryoshka doll, you've got the optical fibers in a silicon gel. It's it's very weird because when I'm describing it, it makes me think of layered pastries. But one thing the cutaways may not show is, you know, like you were talking about, the fact that they may be buried a little bit, and the fact that they're coated with tar pretty often.
Well, yeah, and we found in a couple of different sources that the cabling size differs, because some of them describe them as a garden hose. So you imagine I don't know, the diameter of a garden hose, mm-hmm. or the diameter, again, of a soda can, standard sized wide mouth soda can. And I guess there are just different sizes, because, Ben, we didn't even talk about this yet. Right now on this planet, there are only four companies that are the manufacturers and layers of this type of cable.
And they're not the people who own the cable necessarily. They're not the people who run the information. They're the creators and installers, right?
Yes. Yes. And let's just go through them really quickly. You can look all of these up. In the United States, there's a thing called Subcom. You can check out their website. I was on it earlier. It's interesting. It's fascinating. It's
sure.
cool.
Yeah.
In Japan, there's the NEC Corporation. In France, there's Alcatel Submarine Networks. And in China, there's a company called HMN Tech. And these are pretty much, these are the big players, at least.
Mm-hmm. And some of them are older than others, but everybody does business with them because it's supply and demand. You know what I mean? There are only so many games in town. And these things, these four companies and these cables, they're still using some old tech, some old tactics, some old processes. The ships that lay this cable essentially do it the same way people laid telegraph cable back in the mid-1800s. And some cable makers like Subcom, interesting fact about them, they actually evolved from an old rope manufacturing company that made rope and just happened to have a factory next to a deep water port. So that's history hinges on such small things. And and like you said, these cables are not all created equal. Some are faster than others, better at transmitting more information more consistently. They're taking lessons learned from previous function issues. And there's a great article in CNET by a journalist named Stephen Shankland, and he points out that the fastest transatlantic cable out there right now is funded by Microsoft, Meta, the tech giants. This thing alone can carry 400 terabits of data per second. And Shanklin points out that, for comparison, not to make everybody feel bad about your own gaming rig, 400 terabytes of data per second is 400,000 times faster than your home broadband, even if you have the highest end service available to the public.
Well, that's good, because I'm only assuming that there are 400,000 people using the internet every second that would connect to that cable. There's probably millions of people at any given second using that cable. And I guess they only need a certain amount, you know, a percentage of that huge capacity every second. But good golly, I don't know. We need to get that thing even bigger. We need bigger cables, Ben.
Let's turn the ocean into one big cable. What could go wrong?
Say
the
fine.
Whales. Yeah. So let's go back to telegeography, because I was impressed with their stuff. There's one quote from an analyst there, Alan Malden, who gets quoted in multiple conversations about this. And he does a good job of emphasizing it. He says the whole network of undersea cables is the lifeblood of the economy. It's how we're sending emails and phone calls and YouTube videos and financial transactions. And that last one, I don't know. He's just outlining the public stuff. He's not talking about other factors that may come into play. I think you're nailing it too, Matt. The idea of sharing a ride. Basically, there's this big global subway, and everything that you send or receive hops on the train with strangers.
Oh, some of those strangers on that train, I don't know, might make you nervous. Everybody's fine on the train. If you're somebody, might make you nervous. That's what I'm saying.
Right. So once upon a time, this was primarily the domain of like state powers working with telecom industry players, right? Ma Bell lays a new wire or new cable, et cetera, et cetera. But of course, we've already mentioned them. The new kids on the block are the tech bros, the tech empires, Meta, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, those four primarily, but many others. They've got money to play and they won in the game. They're, what was that term? There's a term we learned for them, hyperscalers, they're called in the industry because of all the money that they have put into play here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Let's talk about it. These guys, these hyperscalers, the Metas and the Amazons and the Googles and the Microsofts, they're responsible for 2/3 of all of that cable traffic. Oh, you know what it's making me think of?
What's that?
Do you remember? Oh, I'm going to blank on it. I think it was Ted Stevens or some other senator a long time ago. They made this comment publicly about a series of tubes and the tubes are getting clogged and all this other stuff. It was something to do with net neutrality. God, that's been a while. But
you're right. It was Ted Stevens.
It was Ted Stevens. Bing, bing, bing. I get a bingo thing for me. Sorry, my brain doesn't generally work like this. But it he got ridiculed for calling the internet a series of tubes or tubes that could get clogged, right? But really, if you visualize it this way, at least the international interconnectivity that becomes the internet, that is the internet, maybe he wasn't that far off.
He really wasn't. You know, these are, when you go down to the nitty gritty, we're talking about physical capability, right?
Yeah.
Even in the so-called cloud, guess what? That rides the subway too. You know what I mean?
It's tube traffic.
Yes, it very much is. Like you said, our big dogs on the tech side are 2/3 of that traffic now, easy. And they are increasing. Analysts say they're surging in their share of the traffic each and every calendar year. This means essentially more people and more businesses are doing more stuff that needs a ride on the information subway. So just like when a city grows, and you get a lot of people moving in, and there are more and more cars on the highway, you have to invest in maintaining and repairing the existing roads.
Or expanding them.
Yeah, you also have to expand them. And then you also have to build entirely new roads. And if you don't, then your city's going to be in a lot of trouble very soon for anybody who's played SimCity. All right, whatever.
Or Atlanta traffic.
Or Atlanta traffic's not a game, but I do feel like I'm playing it now because we're driving back into our office. Oh my gosh. So congratulations to everybody in Atlanta traffic who is driving like they've already made their peace with God or whatever. Oof, I forgot about it, man.
When there is a vehicle in front of the vehicle in front of you, riding on that person's tail doesn't do anything.
It does
just
not.
Just a reminder.
And I've already been racking up more Atlanta war stories. I did find, you know, I used to struggle with road rage, Matt, but I did find a new tactic that I think is helpful and instructive to everybody involved. Since we're an audio show, this might not make sense, but if you are in a traffic heavy area and you have to drive around people who are still kind of like learning about themselves and their car and the world around them.
And, then, you know, laws about keeping to the right if you're going slow.
Sure. And if they're out of blinker fluid or whatever, the best way, in my opinion, the best thing I've found is that yelling at people doesn't work. You know, flipping the bird is just sort of juvenile. What I like to do is point at the person, laugh, and then give them a thumbs down. And that is so much better. And it really does work.
Wow. Of course,
I think it's humorous and appropriate.
Like, you do the gladiator thing. You yes. point at them and then give them a sideways finger, and then it kind of tilts one way or the other, and then goes down.
Hey, and keeping it positive, sometimes I give people a thumbs up too. But you have to be careful to make sure that's not sarcastic. Anyway, that's a different. We got a car episode coming up. It's a doozy. But right now, that car and traffic analogy, I think, is pretty apt because it is a crowded city. It is growing, right? And by any metric, and the trend will accelerate. We've got a couple returning guests in tonight's episode. One would be the shady consultancy McKinsey. They are, in addition to being shady, they're pretty accurate with a lot of their stuff when it serves their purpose to be so. And they said that undersea cable links are going to grow at an economy of scale. Already reached that part. So the internet hopefully will get faster for everyone. Prices will hopefully get lower. We'll see about that. And then they said this will all lead to like a 4% boost in global employment, a 7% boost in economic activity. It sounds like a win-win if everybody can behave.
Sure. And everybody's going to make so much money. Oh, wait, four companies. And then I guess the telecommunications companies after that will make a lot of money. That same outfit you found, Ben, Telegeography, projects that $10 billion is going to be spent on new subsea cables from this year, 2023, for the next 2 years, 2025. And that's global. $10 billion is going to be spent on laying new stuff and also spent on repairing, you know, issues that happen to the cables and maintaining those systems. And that's mostly going to be handled by those four big companies.
Yeah, exactly. Because again, they're the only ones in town, and it's kind of like semiconductor foundries. Building a manufacturing base, there's a pretty tall milkshake. It's a tough order. This
well,
sounds
we didn't even talk
business.
About Ben. Mm. You can't physically get a human down there to work on the cables to like send a repair person.
Not yet.
Seriously, when you lay the stuff, it's a trawler that you have to drop down that doesn't have any biological material on it. It's just a machine and it lays the cable. Then when one breaks or you're laying a new one, you do the same thing because humans don't exist at those depths.
Mm-hmm. None have been proven to exist at those depths for very long at all. So this sounds great for business. Again, win-win if possible. And the monopoly of companies or the small oligarchy of companies that are able to do this or making money hand over fist, right? And they're doing their best work. But around the world, despite all this good stuff, cables are an increasing concern for pretty much everybody who thinks about them for more than a few minutes. They are fragile. They're incredibly important. That means if you want to attack someone, these cables are a fantastic target. You can kind of see where we're going with this. Welcome to a new theater of the continuing war. A lot of journalists have pointed out the attack or the sabotage of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines. And look, put morals and ethics and, you know, your favorite teams aside. Just look at the logistics. That's a difficult operation. It's easy for us to sit somewhere and read about it and say, well, you know, just go to a part where nobody's hanging out and blow it up. But there's a lot going into that because people have their eyes on those pipelines. It's way easier, even with remote parts of the seabed, it's way easier to just cut the garden hose.
Yeah. It's hard to see through, you know, miles of water.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, whatever. It's hard to see that stuff. And, you know, and that is weird to think about, Ben, because there is a ton of surveillance under the water when it comes to like hubs where these cables are laid, but there are huge swaths of them that are just cable under, like barely underneath the surface, and it's just there and nobody's watching, you know. Again, we're talking hundreds of feet, thousands of feet of cable that are exposed that if you knew where to go and just dropped something a little heavy and sharp onto the ocean floor.
Not even explosive.
No, literally sharp.
Mm-hmm. And former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev spooked some people when he said, yeah, these subsea cables, they're fair game in a conflict. Why
international, wouldn't international waters?
Yeah, he seemed kind of irritated. He was like, why wouldn't you? What? Come on, man. Do you even war? And And then if you start looking at, this is something that's kind of the heart of the show here. We want to look at the choke points, want to look at the conspiracies that will naturally blossom in this environment. Take Taiwan, the archipelago of Taiwan. It has 27 subsea cable connections right now. If, and this is just if, you were someone who had an opinion about the future of Taiwan and you wanted to impose your will or your opinion about the future, then you would start with the cables. That's one of the things you would do if your operation goes hot.
And one thing to keep in mind when we're talking about severing these cables, these companies can repair a broken cable, let's say, or a missing piece of cable in hours. It's potentially possible to repair something within hours, but it's also more likely that it's going to take a lot longer than that, right? And if one of these cables is attacked, it would probably be strategically timed to where communications are cut off to, you know, a specific place like a Taiwan, let's say. And then another type of attack would occur. So it's almost like turning the lights off, right? If you're just putting the whole thing on a house and it's a home intruder and they cut the lights and we're in a scary movie, that's the first thing they do.
Yeah, we'll get into some systems theory here too, but think of like a physical DDoS attack. That's what you can do. You can overload the system due to the relatively high number, due to a couple of calculations, which we're going to allude to, but for the sake of everybody, we're probably not going to do the actual calculation / math on air. But you can play along at home and tell us what you think, of course. So even another returning guest, shady one at that, in Qtel is worried about the possibility of cables becoming a theater in the next war.
You remember in Qtel, right? Those are the guys that put money into stuff that the CIA and the FBI and other intelligence agencies in the U.S. want them to put money into. What? But they're a nonprofit, right? But they are CIA backed. But they do good stuff, but also the NSA is involved. It's weird.
Yeah. And every government agency you have ever had a problem with outside of the IRS is involved with Qtel.
Do and some searches for Qtel and Facebook.
Check out our episode before the cables go. So anyway, do check it out. The current president of Qtel is a guy named Steve Bauscher. And he said, quote, "There's a lot of talk these days about how space is the next contested domain. But I think undersea is going to be very much a contested domain. Those are going to be targets in any sort of, get this, Matt, kinetic conflict," which is just like, look, Qtel is a heavy player. They do a lot of stuff. Kinetic conflict is kind of, to me, a non-helpful euphemism. We all know what you're talking about.
See, but you really got to bring inertia into this, you know, like, is it at rest or does it want to stay there or is it already moving? What kind of kinetic energy was applied to this war?
Yeah, exactly. And I guess before we go too far down the undersea rabbit hole, we do have to make a note. The reason, Matt, that you and I are talking so much about the fragility of these cables is that there does not have to be a conspiracy, nor sabotage, nor an act of war or terrorism for these things to get screwed up to the point of, you mentioned about just dropping something heavy and sharp.
Yeah.
That happens all the time because storms hit the ocean and ships are all over the ocean and they drop their anchor and the storm blows them and the anchor just pulls the cable out.
God dang it. We got another cable. What? No.
Oh, we're here for the tuna. Anyway, 85% of cuts and damage to cable currently comes from fishing equipment and anchors. And then there are natural disasters that occur, like you mentioned, Pacific Islands, often, which only have one connecting cable. Tonga is a great example. Volcanic eruption screws up the cable. They lost communication for weeks. It was a double plus ungood situation. So even in times of peace, just like you said, with the road analogy, you have to constantly maintain this stuff, improve it, check on it. It's all very expensive. And that's just to keep it running, not to make it better at all. That's just to keep this kind of jury-rigged contraption going.
Yeah. I think about AC companies or car manufacturers, or not car manufacturers, car dealerships. We just talked about this, Ben. A car dealership makes a lot of money selling cars, but not the bulk of their money. Most of the money at a major car dealership is made through maintenance, of vehicles it sells, and signing somebody into a contract to only get their car worked on in that place where they bought their car. That's the trick. Like, and it's kind of the same with these companies laying cable, right? They're going to make most of their money fixing the stuff that they've already built.
Yeah. I hate that we both know that from experience now. You know what I mean? What a bummer. Anyway, so warranties, that's another good episode. There's another problem here. This stuff is an excellent target for kinetic conflicts, because just like spy satellites, it's incredibly difficult, if not operationally impossible, to keep the location of these things secret if powerful forces really want to know. Now, you, as the public, if you're listening and you're a civilian, you can see all kinds of maps like SubCom, and they'll usually have some caveat like location is approximate or something. Mm-hmm. The location is not approximate for a lot of the big players. They know, right? And some state governments that might be beefed up with each other are also in a position where they can force the tech bros to tell them everything legally, right? And geography decides everything on this planet. Subsea cable routes are no exception. That's where we got to talk about something that I think fascinates both of us, Matt. The car, to take the traffic analogy, one of the biggest traffic jams is in Egypt.
Yeah, I never would have expected this. Check out the article, The Most Vulnerable Place on the Internet. It's written by Matt Burgess for Wired. And it's November 2nd, 2022. Pretty recent writing.
Pretty up to speed even now.
Oh, yeah. There are six cables that Matt Burgess points out that are concentrated through the Red Sea, and they actually go over the land in Egypt. If you go to that same website we told you about before, the map, you can actually see where they go over land in Egypt. And that's what we call a choke point. Why, Ben?
Well, Matt, we call it a choke point because if you wanted to... Okay, 17% of all the internet traffic in the world goes along these cables. It passes through Egypt. And this is due to geography. Without some sci-fi level terraforming, there's no way to get rid of this choke point.
There's not. And you can, again, it is striking. If you pull out on that map, then you zoom in towards Egypt, kind of the northeast side of Egypt, you see where all of those cables, it's like you were talking about, it's like a cable tie is wrapped around them. It's nuts. And that's just before they go overland in Egypt while heading to the northwest.
Yes, exactly. And let's go back to Wired. I love that we're citing this one. So Matt Burgess says, passing through the Red Sea and across Egypt is the shortest primarily underwater routes between Asia and Europe. And you can take some of these cables across land, but it's generally going to be safer for them to be at the bottom of the sea because it's tougher to disrupt them or compromise them, which we'll talk about later at the end.
Oh, man, we didn't talk about compromising these things yet.
We
did.
It'll come up at the end, right? So every other possible route in this area is a logistical pain in the butt. If you look at the south, pull up that map Matt mentioned earlier, then you'll see cables can pass around Africa undersea, but they're much longer. You know, it's like the old maritime days of sailing around the Cape. And if you go to the north, you'll see there's only one cable that travels above Russia. Its street name, the Polar Express. Love it. But it's just not practical for what we need stuff to do. And if you try to do alternative routes, which people have been trying to do for years and years now, Then you run into the second problem, economy or war. Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, aka the graveyard of empires. That's not a place where you want to run a cable.
Yeah, but the old conspira brain is doing something here, Ben.
Ooh, what you got cooking?
Whereas the U.S. been focusing their kinetic efforts right in those areas.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, gosh. They are resource rich, aren't they? And, of course, the Strait of Hormuz is its own little story to be told. That's a really good point, Matt. Now you're in my head about it. Okay, and so they go through the Red Sea, right? We've got to get back to those countries and the grand aims in a future episode. The Red Sea is not perfect by any means for this sort of stuff because the Red Sea is big. It's a sea, but it's shallow, and that means it's way easier to get down there and get up to some gremlin shenanigans. As a matter of fact, in 2013, the Egyptian Navy arrested three people who were doing just that. They were like, oh, these cables aren't that far away. Let's get friggin' kinetic.
See what happens. Snip. It's way harder than a little snip. But yeah, it's pretty crazy. If you look at that map, you can see where there are vulnerabilities, minor choke points that exist across the planet. Places where if you had bad intentions, you could do some serious damage to the connectivity of large swaths of land.
Very quickly as well. Yeah. So Egypt, Taiwan, those are just two examples of a trend that continues across the globe. And yeah, the system itself does have redundancy. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, the people who run companies as smart as tech empires are not going to say, yeah, one cable, that's fine, because they are so used to people losing their minds when the internet goes out. So not even like I kid you not even like worried about saboteurs or war. They're worried about their customer service departments getting overwhelmed. So they have multiple cables or space on multiple cables because they need that redundancy. If one thing goes out, then they have another route, hopefully. And they have a lot of redundancy here. It's very smart. That's how you want a system to be built. But some countries like Tonga still just have the one connecting cable. And if you're one of those four companies that you mentioned, Matt, when something goes wrong, they have the ability to pinpoint where the cut occurs. So they can isolate it, but they often have to get a government permit because these are cables that go across nations. They have to get a government permit to operate. So a repair can take 2 weeks on average. But if anything else goes wrong during that time, the repair window automatically extends. Like in the wake of Fukushima, one repair took 2 months. Yeah. And that means if we think in terms of system analysis, to your earlier point, if you are a bad faith actor, if you are an attacker, you have some advantages depending on your goal. Like the Taiwanese example we're talking about. So they have 27 cables. And if they wanted to cut off, if China or some other attacker, just for the sake of argument, wanted to cut off Taiwan and cripple them in advance of a physical war, they would just need to overwhelm the repair capabilities. They cut the 27 cables at once as close to simultaneously as possible. Just like in Breaking Bad, spoiler, where Walter White has all those people killed within 2 minutes at the prison. Just do that.
Well, what if the strategy was to have a dedicated connection from a different angle that didn't require those cables to connect to the interior systems? Then you cut the exterior systems so communications can't go out or come in from other parts of the world, but you could still connect to the systems via the land, right? Mm-hmm. There's potential there to basically take everyone off guard by breaking most communications, but still being able to function within systems at the same time while they're disconnected. That's really creepy. Because you're talking about like financial hits. You're talking about stuff that could cripple systems without any kinetic maneuvers.
Yes. Asymmetric warfare, 100%. This is an excellent example of it. And I like your scenario, too.
I don't. Well, I don't like that scenario at all.
I think it's intellectually simulating. So there's all, I guess I have to say that too, right? So, you know, what happens then really, even if you're not putting boots on the ground, you're extending that repair window, right? And that, and as we know, a lot can change within a month or two. So you've gone, now you've gone from 2 weeks to maybe months on the outside. And there's also the ability for industrial espionage, terrorism in the corporate front, very like Shadowrun terrorism. If you, do you remember that game, Shadowrun?
Yeah.
Shadowrun's amazing. Okay, so it's a little tricky if you're one of those cats because of the redundancy of cable, the difficulty of reaching them all at once. You want to do a war of a thousand cuts. So the cost benefit, which we're not going to do in depth, is this. Most breaks in the cables occur in shallow water because there's, that's where most of the boat traffic is likely to hit them with an anchor. Those also get repaired much more quickly, much more easily. So you would want to eat the cost of getting out in the deep, deep water, cutting cables at the most inaccessible places, which requires some specific equipment. So you would probably want to be careful about how you procure that. This raises your effort, but it also massively increases the amount of effort someone has to undertake to repair it. There are only a few companies that can do this. It's, again, an intellectually fascinating game, and it's probably best for us not to do the math on air.
Yeah, let's not do the math. Because you could develop, let's say, a brand new type of submarine that gets introduced in the past couple of months that just happened. Maybe that submarine has some quiet technology that is literally a heavy, sharp thing that you could drag across the ocean floor. So that's all you would need to do, especially if that submarine was very quiet and difficult to detect.
Especially if that submarine actually worked, which is up for debate.
Yeah, that's true. I know.
but yes, you're making a beautiful point. That's a problem. That's asymmetrical warfare, classic textbook. You know, if you have an enemy who outperforms economically or in terms of infrastructure, you don't have to waste untold billions of dollars trying to catch up with them. You can spend a lot less money just to break the thing they made, which is, we live in interesting times. And like I said, you know, we knew we were not going to get to everything here. We've only explored the physical dangers. We do want to do that plot twist you mentioned as well, Matt. We both alluded to, we have not talked about Puzzle Palace level compromise of data in the cables, which is happening. We have not talked about interception or the insertion, interposition of purposely misleading information.
Yeah, these are fiber optic cables. You can split off fiber optic cables and duplicate the data. The United States figured out how to do that a while ago. Remember when we talked about that one? When they went, let's just look at all the data. Where can we plug in? Oh, look, we can just plug in to the literal pipes and duplicate the pipes and see everything. I'm using the phrase pipes on purpose. Okay.
And we want to keep it a secret. So let's make sure this skyscraper doesn't have any windows. That way no one can look in and it won't seem suspicious.
Oh, the Long Lines building. Check it out. It's in Manhattan and it's really creepy. Mm-hmm. Can I really quick shout out before we end here, Ben, somebody named Johnny Harris, awesome reporter, journalist. He's got a great YouTube channel. That's the way I interact with his content. Mm-hmm. He made a video not long ago in August titled Submarine Cables and the Rise of Mass Surveillance. If you are interested in the surveillance side of this, we would highly recommend checking that out.
Yeah. And I want to highlight at the end here maybe it's just a restatement here. It's short-term effective to cut these cables as an act of kinetic conflict. It is long-term effective and arguably more intelligent to compromise the cables, because if you are playing the cat and mouse of espionage, or if you're on the road to a hot war, then you don't want people to know that you have an ear to the ground on them. So you would never tell people. Then you compromise the cables. All to say, I imagine this small handful of manufacturers and installers, I imagine they get a lot of interesting meetings. You know what I mean? And you have to wonder what their social media is like. Anyway, these are the genuine concerns. It turns out that human beings haven't changed all that much since that unknown scribe decided to zhuzh up the hieroglyphs. So what happens next? What do you think, folks? Is this critical infrastructure going to be targeted the way that power plants are being targeted in the U.S. now, which just sort of faded from the news, but is definitely still happening? We can't wait to hear your thoughts. Find us online while the cables still run. Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, X, nay, Twitter. And if you don't care for that, you can always, always give us a phone call.
Yes, our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. You've got 3 minutes, give yourself a cool nickname, and let us know if we can use your message and voice on the air. It's that simple. If you want to send us a bunch of information, if you need an undersea cable to get us stuff, why not instead send us a good old-fashioned email? We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.